Good Wednesday evening. This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday night, June 10th, 2020, and this is your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Ahead tonight, we continue our series about COVID-19 and Arkansas prisons, and in just a few minutes, we hear from two people who are part of a task force to examine police training and procedures in Arkansas. Zuzanna Sitek talks with them just ahead. Tomorrow on 91.3 on Fresh Air, Terry Gross will talk with Pete Davidson, the youngest cast member of Saturday Night Live. He stars in the new movie, The King of Staten Island, which draws on his life as the son of a firefighter killed on 9/11. Also a conversation with Judd Apatow, who directed the film that will be available on demand Friday. Fresh Air tomorrow at 11 a.m. and 6 p.m., followed by our Thursday edition of Ozarks at Large on 91.3. Arkansas is moving to phase two of a reopening schedule on Monday. Governor Asa Hutchinson made that announcement today during his press briefing in Little Rock. The move means the easing of some restrictions for businesses, including restaurants allowed to operate at two-thirds indoor capacity. The move to phase two comes as the state reports 288 new cases in the most recent 24-hour monitoring period, including 228 community cases. Governor Hutchinson says there is no scientific evidence that new cases in the state are related to the phase one openings of the past 35 days.
There's no evidence of a correlation. This is because the restaurants, the gyms, the barbershops, and salons are taking precautions and they value their patrons and they're following the public health guidelines.
The governor says moving to phase two does not mean the state is out of the woods of what he says is a public health emergency. In fact, today he extended his emergency order for another 45 days, past its expiration in the middle of this month. Arkansas's three most populated counties, Pulaski, Washington, and Benton, had the most new cases reported in the past 24-hour period, 51, 44, and 37 respectively. The governor says the continued rise in cases in northwest Arkansas remains a concern.
But in Benton and Washington counties, we're going to provide additional support to target the surge in cases there in Benton and Washington County. And so we're assigning additional testing, tracing, and public health support to those areas so that we can better constrain the virus and prevent its spread.
Dr. Nate Smith, Arkansas's Secretary of Health, says precautions are still needed even as the state moves to a new phase of activity.
Wear masks when out in public when we cannot maintain that 6-foot physical distancing. We need to maintain that physical distancing whenever possible, and we need to wash our hands. We need to look out for each other, avoid these large crowds as much as possible. But you can see we've got areas in the eastern part of the state, areas in the western part of the state, a few in the southern part of the state. So we can't let our guard down really anywhere in the state. We've got to keep on keeping on in order to interrupt the transmission of COVID-19.
There have been 10,368 cumulative cases of COVID-19 in Arkansas, and during the most recent 24-hour monitoring period, there were an additional 4 deaths from the virus, bringing the fatality total to 165. Dr. Smith says the state has conducted nearly 40,000 tests so far in June, keeping the state on pace to administer 120,000 tests throughout the month. The briefings with the governor and state officials are archived at Governor Hutchinson's YouTube channel. This is Ozarks at Large. Following protests in Arkansas and across the country in response to the killing of George Floyd by a white Minneapolis police officer, Governor Asa Hutchinson signed an executive order forming a task force that will propose improvements to the ways policing is currently conducted in Arkansas. The committee, which he announced yesterday, will be made up of Black Lives Matter protest organizers, law enforcement officials, and city leaders.
I want to cover a little bit of the purposes of this task force. The members of the task force shall have the following duties: to review the adequacy of law enforcement training, policy, and operations specifically related to cultural, racial, and community relations; to study and analyze the processes for accountability, discipline, removal, and decertification of officers who do not meet the standards, including an evaluation for the creation and implementation of a statewide public database of complaints and resolutions concerning law enforcement officers. It's also to review community policing and how that can be enhanced in Arkansas and more effective, to study the standards, requirements, and obstacles in recruitment, hiring, and retention of law enforcement officers, recognizing the important work that they do, make recommendations to the governor on enhancing the trust between law enforcement and the communities, and make recommendations to the governor on improvements or changes needed to enhance the profession of law enforcement to ensure compliance with standards.
The governor noted that the state's law enforcement standards were established over 45 years ago, and there has not been a comprehensive review of those standards since then. He also emphasized his support for the state's law enforcement, their dedication, sacrifice, and the critical role they play in public safety.
I also want to be clear that there will not be an agenda item on defunding law enforcement through this task force. Now, it is always a fair discussion as to how funding is used and where the needs are, and that discussion is fair and can be a part of this. But I've talked to the members of the task force, and this is not to take away from law enforcement. This is to enhance law enforcement.
The task force will be chaired by Fred Weatherspoon, who is the deputy director of the Arkansas Law Enforcement Training Academy. During yesterday's announcement, he talked about his first encounter with law enforcement officers at the age of 10.
My father was arrested some years ago in Jefferson County, and he was arrested, and then he was doing the process of this arrest, so he was subject to excessive force by the officers at the time. To the point that when my mother and my uncle brought him home, that myself and my older brother, we ran from him because we didn't recognize him because of the severity of the beating he had received. So throughout my remaining years, I too had a different perspective about law enforcement and their true purpose.
After graduating from Southern Arkansas University, Weatherspoon says a friend offered him a job at the Magnolia Police Department, which he initially declined because of the story you just heard.
But after a few days of deliberating on this conversation, and he had said, "Fred, that would be your opportunity to make a difference, to make a meaningful difference in law enforcement and how people view law enforcement in the future." And with that encouragement from him, I went set and talked with the mayor at the time, and I accepted his offer to become a police officer with the city of Magnolia, Arkansas. Through that opportunity to become involved with the city and the community leaders, I feel like that we did make a difference in how police were received and accepted in the city of Magnolia, Arkansas.
Besides Weatherspoon, the task force includes 17 other members at the moment, but the governor has the right to appoint additional citizens to the committee later if he feels it's necessary. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek spoke with two of the task force members via Zoom following the governor's announcement. They are Kendrell Collins, who is an assistant federal public defender, and Jimmy Warren, who is a community activist in Conway.
I thought we could start by talking about how your involvement in your communities and in the recent protests have put you in a position to be on this task force. Why did the governor ask both of you to join?
I'll let you go first, Kendrell.
Okay. I think primarily it comes from just engagement in various groups and organizations. I'm a board member with the Dunbar Historic Neighborhood Association, which is a very treasured African-American neighborhood here in Little Rock. Of course, there's Urban League Young Professionals. We have a committee that works on the census right now, and so I'm the census chair of that, trying to push, making sure that people in our community, specifically African-American communities, are counted. So I think it's a collection of involvement and associations with the other people who were doing the protests.
Yeah, as for me, I've been involved here on the ground with just community service projects around the city of Conway, minority business summits, reaching out to local influencers to give away money to small businesses. So I've been involved here in Conway, where I'm familiar with my local government. So when everything sprung, I just immediately reached out to them with suggestions for change. And then our community just had protests and they're still ongoing. So I'm not sure where the request came from or how the governor's office got my name, but it just came somewhere from Conway. We didn't have a lot of news coverage or anything here. So I believe someone just submitted that name that had noticed the work that had been going on here.
And before this task force was formed and announced, both of you submitted letters to the governor asking for racial and criminal justice in 2020. What did you outline in those letters? What did you want the governor to know?
I think if I remember correctly, it seems like so long ago, but I broke mine into policy, training, and funding. So just providing insight on what categories that we could quickly talk to, and then what categories we kind of could strategically work around. Again, the great thing about the governor and this invitation was that he was willing to listen, even though that we did not agree on every issue, and that's okay. I think he talked about that in his press conference today, but he was willing to listen and remove the politician side and actually be human and express his deep concern for what was going on and work together to find solutions.
Yeah, and it was important for me to make sure that it wasn't just in terms of the demands or proposals that we presented to the governor, that it wasn't just like my voice or my small group. So I reached out just on social media and asked people, look, how can you contribute? Can you let me know what are some things that we should be putting on our agenda to request from the governor? And I don't think that they were necessarily divided into specific groups, but I think they are. They could be divided, in my opinion, into police reform, broader criminal justice reform, and then the underlying really like racial reconciliation and transformation.
What's at the top of your mind, your minds as you're going into this task force? What are sort of the things that are you feel should be immediately addressed?
I think for, and this is just me speaking, I certainly don't speak for everyone. I think our initial meeting that's going to take place next week, that's kind of where we start. Just to kind of pool ideas. At this point, I don't know if one idea is bigger than the other or one is more important, but we know that we have a direct line to listening ears to get things done. So I think the biggest thing is just to get us all in the room, and then we'll kind of work out what's the right approach to getting these accomplishments taken care of.
Yeah, I definitely agree with Mr. Warren. I think that it needs to be a collective decision. And a lot of us are in close contact with each other, especially the ones who were community leaders that met with him. Of course, there's some things that have got to be addressed as far as like accountability. You know, the governor mentioned the statewide database and dealing with complaints. That was one of the things that we presented. Training is absolutely important. You know, 13 weeks of training is simply not enough. I've talked to so many police officers. My own dad is a police chief. It's not enough, especially when you got like decades of, racial bias kind of baked into your subconscious. Like those are some of the top things on my list.
So what are the issues that you see in Arkansas in terms of the way law enforcement is conducted? What would you like to see changed and addressed?
I think one, and this was the one that I started my letter off with, was just removing the responsibility of individual municipalities investigating officer-involved shootings. I feel that the Arkansas State Police, as the third-party organization, should investigate all officer-involved shootings. I think that there is a direct conflict of interest when local municipalities kind of investigate themselves with officer-involved shootings. So just removing that responsibility and putting it upon the Arkansas State Police.
Another one just to throw in there, I think is very important, and I believe Mayor Frank Scott and the police chief here in Little Rock addressed it today. You need to change the culture. And so part of that is creating a duty to intervene with the other officers who, you know, there are a lot of great officers, and there are some who are just kind of loose cannons. And so when you get the good officers empowered to say something, giving people a duty to say something, that changes a lot. There's a whole lot of things. Body cameras, as you know, I'm a public defender, so I see sometimes there's no video evidence. There was a stop, and all we have is somebody's word, and it's their word against mine. And And body cameras should be mandatory, that we should have funding for that. There should be discipline for people who don't wear them and don't turn them on. Very simple things like that.
In his media conference, the governor said up front that this task force is not about defunding the police, which has been this idea that's been going around about lowering the funding for police departments across the country. Is that, do you see that as a problem? Do you feel like it will impede anything, or is that something you can work with?
Well, if I recall correctly, the governor, even though he did say, and I think he felt the need to make clear that we're not talking about defunding, he did say we can have a discussion, should have a discussion about where money goes. And so that's meeting people halfway. We understand that there are like extreme sides to this. And I think the people at the table that we're at are about like the issues that we can agree on. We can agree that yes, if we can direct funding to specific training, to specific programs, like then that works. We're not going to get the whole loaf here, but I think there could be some healthy compromise.
Echoing exactly what Kendrell said, I don't think there's anything else to add to it. The governor has expressed his openness and willingness to discuss those issues. So should we come across something, I think that the table is open for the discussion, and we'll definitely compromise if we need to.
So what kind of experience are both of you hoping to bring to this task force?
Just the ability to rally people and hear from my community and bring those ideas to the table, because I think a lot of us, Mr. Collins is in Little Rock and from Osceola, I'm in Conway and from Crosses. So we each have different life experiences. So just being able to share that and also share our community's needs, because Conway and Little Rock look very different. But just being able to speak to the community that we represent, and make sure that voice is heard at the table.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. Like you mentioned, we come from what some would call smaller towns in Arkansas, like, and we live now in bigger cities, but we represent both. And I think having that voice, bringing that to the table, bringing our youth to the table, we speak for a different generation than some of the people on the board, bringing our experiences just on the ground level. We've been out there, you know, protesting as well. It's not just like being in the background in the boardroom, but also like, you know, for me, being in the courtroom, like, gives me a lot of insight into, okay, people talk about like criminal justice and the system is biased. But when you actually step in there and go watch, like, you can see, and I recommend that like everyday people go, and like, it's public. People can go see it for themselves, how it plays out in real life.
So when you heard the governor was developing this task force, what were your first thoughts when he announced it and when you were invited to be a part of it?
It's just an overwhelming opportunity. I think that just being recognized by the governor is just amazing and a great personal accolade. But with that just comes a lot of responsibility, because you just have to realize that it's not about your ideologies or your ideas. Then now you are working for the greater good of Arkansas. And that means that you may not have the best ideas, you may not have the best approach, but you just got to put those things to the side so that Arkansas can prosper in this situation.
Yeah, and I don't think it's any surprise that the people that you saw invited to be a part of the task force were invited. We asked for this, and he answered that, and I really respect him following through on his word with the executive order and appointing members of the group. You know, we said in solidarity, like, we want to be at the table as a collective. Of course, all of us couldn't be there. You got different groups represented, the movement, a group called Carbon Community Activists Rebuilding Our Nation. We're in dialogue with them, even though some of them may not be at the table. Like, we're all, our voices at the table.
That was Kendrell Collins, an assistant federal public defender, and Jimmy Warren, a community activist in Conway, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek. They are both part of the governor's newly announced task force to advance the state of law enforcement in Arkansas. We'll hear more from the conversation in just a moment on this edition of Ozarks at Large.
Covering the pandemic has required significant investments both here at KUAF and at NPR. We have embraced new ways of working, helped journalists and hosts to broadcast from home, invested in equipment and protective gear to keep our journalists safe, all while drastically increasing our output. We've added these services while navigating the same financial realities that are impacting every industry. Today, when unbiased journalism is so important, KUAF is seeking your support to sustain our work. During the month of June, we hope to raise $35,000 to offset losses experienced during our spring fundraiser and in underwriting from local businesses. We're asking you to help us meet this goal. We know not everyone can afford to donate, but whatever you can give will help us keep vital, trustworthy information flowing to you and your community. Your donation today will determine what is possible in the months ahead, because in uncertain times, your support keeps us going. Please make a gift at supportkuaf.com.
And we appreciate your support in the past and your support right now. That support enables reporters like Antoinette Grajeda to produce stories and interviews that help us all know more about where we live, about our neighbors, and what's important to this region and the entire state. You can make a contribution, if you're able, at supportkuaf.com right now. This comes as we near the end of our fiscal year at 91.3 KUAF. An amount in your choosing. And from all of us that work at Ozarks at Large, thank you very much.
Walmart Museum presents Live at the Five and Dime virtual concert series every Wednesday at 5 p.m. on Facebook. This series is a collaboration with University of Arkansas Department of Music and Downtown Bentonville Incorporated. More information available at walmartmuseum.com under events.
This is Ozarks at Large. Let's get back to Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek's conversation with Kendrell Collins, an assistant federal public defender, and Jimmy Warren, a community activist in Conway, both of whom have been appointed to a law enforcement task force announced yesterday by Governor Asa Hutchinson.
Why do you think the killing of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer is resonating like this across America? Why are these protests taking place basically everywhere?
Yeah, the analogy that I've been given is you got to rewind back 5 or 6 years ago with Trayvon Martin shooting, and it was like a Coke can that was shaken up and then sat back down. And then a couple of years later, you had Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old boy in Ohio who was gunned down by the police for playing with the toy gun. Once again, the Coke can was shaken up and then it was sat back down. And then you had Jordan Dunn, who was murdered sitting in his car by a vigilante. And then once again, the Coke can was shaken up and then sitting that down. And then 4 weeks ago, we saw Breonna Taylor in St. Louis, who was shot by officers who were serving a warrant at the wrong address. We saw the situation in Central Park where an African-American bird watcher was called upon by a lady calling the police that flat out lied on camera saying that he was attacking her. And so the unfortunate time where we witnessed George Floyd being murdered on live video, that was the time where the can was shaking up and it just exploded. So this has been something that's been going on for a while. And I think it was kind of one of those perfect storm situations. Everyone had been in the house for 12 weeks with COVID and everyone's anxious about coming out. So the first time we see protests and we see people outside, it just was a perfect storm that fortunately has been working together to get progress across the United States.
Absolutely. There's only so much trauma that people of color in particular can endure without crying out. And the unique part about this is that it's happening in the middle of a pandemic. It's happening where we can see the effects in real time. We have, you know, the information about COVID-19 impacting Black people disproportionately. We're seeing it. This is no longer something that we can argue with. There's data. And then we have video. America responds to, unfortunately, to extreme tragedy, to violence. And that's what triggers us. And this moment was just the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of we really can't take it anymore. And I think there's been so much unity in that. And this is just a moment and people are seizing it to know that if we're going to make the changes and the reforms, you need to do it when you have the movement.
In terms of the protests that have been happening, you know, people are protesting. We have this task force now. What else should people be thinking about, you know, besides protesting or in addition to protesting?
Talking to your local community members and those in local government, change starts right there in your own community. So I would encourage everyone, if you see something that you want changed or you feel like you can influence something, reach out, not just by letter. We live in a world that should be thankful for social media because it creates the need for a middleman. You can go straight to the source. Most local politicians, city council members, and mayors have a direct Facebook or social media page. So if you have any questions about their platform or what new issues are arising, you have a direct line to reach out to them and submit your suggestions. Just make sure that you remain respectful, because most of the time they'll listen to you. But just come in with your agenda and action items and work to see what you can get accomplished.
I agree. I think that there's two ways to approach activism. Like, there's the direct, like, reach out to your legislator, reach out to your representative. And that's extremely important, because some of these things that we're going to the governor with, he doesn't have the power to do certain things. He can encourage, but it's the legislator who's going to have to make some of these changes. But then there's also, like, the side of the deeper issue is, like I mentioned, the racial biases. That's more of a heart condition, and we have to begin to be engaged in dialogue and communication at our churches, in our organizations, and do it in a way that's inclusive.
And, you know, what's your message to protesters? Because I don't think we've seen the last of local protests where you guys live, and then in Northwest Arkansas, I don't think we've seen the last of it either. What's kind of your message to all the protesters out there who are still planning to go out in the, you know, the town squares and walk the streets?
Yeah, I think so. The peaceful protests have been great. I think because we've seen a direct impact and we've seen people in power positions listen, I think that the generation now that is leading the protests is going to feel more empowered. So I definitely think that protests are going to come back as they were in the 60s and 70s. I think we're going to see a lot more protests of people standing up for issues and fighting the power structure that they don't agree with. I think it's going to be just a remarkable time, and hopefully we'll see a lot of positive change moving forward.
To the protesters, I would say, number one, every generation has its kind of defining moment, right? You know, Mr. Warren just mentioned the civil rights movement. I feel like this is the new civil rights movement of our generation. And people don't remember that the civil rights movement wasn't just a couple months, a couple weeks. Like, we're talking spanning a whole decade or more. And protesters should know, like, what they're doing is working. Like, sounding the alarm, people organizing is working. I mean, we can see it in 1 week. And I think it's important that we keep doing that, that we keep that momentum, but we also bring that momentum into policy. Like, I feel like it's a symbiotic relationship between people who are on the streets protesting and people who are also in the background pushing policy. Like, we need both, like, to even keep the attention on the policy. So I say, like, keep going, keep doing it. And we're doing it with them.
When I was at the Bentonville protest this weekend, one of the organizers mentioned that she believes that in order for there to be any kind of change, you know, protest organizers and people who would like to see change have to reach out to law enforcement and other people in power to work with them to make that happen. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, in an ideal world, the people wouldn't have to reach out to the leaders, wouldn't have to do all this. In an ideal world, they represent us and they should be coming to us. And some are, to be truthful. But I think, yes, we gotta come to the table and do this together. We're forced to exist in this whole society together. And I am like very like stubbornly hopeful about the process, even though it is like very disappointing at times, but like moments like this, you know, bring hope. I know it's possible in real life, just because like I said, living with a father who's a police officer, and you begin to see, okay, what does this really look like from all sides? Like, a police officer can like come from the community that they represent. They can like not use excessive force. My father would never put his foot on my neck while I'm on the ground handcuffed. Like, there's certain things that you don't do, but obviously like training and policies can't make up for all of that. Like, but I think it begins to shift the culture, and that's the long game I think we're playing, and we got to keep doing that. And that involves like talking to the people with the power.
Obviously, this task force is in its very, very early stages, but once the end of December rolls around, when the governor wants this group to submit its report, what are you hoping to have achieved by that time?
It's real simple. I know for me, I don't have one idea that I want to put forth. I don't have one agenda item on there. I just want to work with the professional people that have been appointed to this board that we're on, and work with other community leaders and the police that's out there to come up with solutions to enhance the communication and transparency in Arkansas.
Yeah, I want to see a radical kind of revolution of what we value in the state of Arkansas. I want to see us valuing racial reconciliation. I want to see us valuing criminal justice and police, not just reform, but really transformation. And people really realizing that police are not separate from the community. Like, we're all part of the same community, and everybody being on board, and this not being a blue issue or a red issue, but that justice and equality is for everybody. And this shouldn't be something that we're really debating. And I think the task force putting tangible concrete, like, you know, a tangible agenda on the table is going to help to spark that. But it's definitely like just the beginning. I don't think this is by any means going to be the solution to our problems.
Thank you both very much for speaking with us.
Oh, yeah, no problem. Have a great day.
Thank you so much, Susanna. We appreciate it.
That was Kendrell Collins, an assistant federal public defender, and Jimmy Warren, a community activist in Conway, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Susanna Sitek. They are both part of the governor's newly announced task force to advance the state of law enforcement in Arkansas. Other members also include Washington County Sheriff Tim Helder and Emma Davis and Layla Holloway, who are both community activists in Van Buren.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Make Do, an exhibit on 19th and 20th century Ozark ingenuity, is available online at shilohmuseum.org. This exhibit showcases clever ways that folks in the 18 and 1900s transformed discarded and found materials and used them to make or repair everyday objects. Make Do is available for viewing online at shilohmuseum.org under exhibits.
This is Ozarks at Large. Thanks for being with us on this Wednesday. The largest outbreak of COVID-19 cases in Arkansas has been at a state prison in Lincoln County. 11 people confirmed to have the disease died at the Cummins unit. One of them was Derek Coley. As part of the National Geographic Society's Emergency Fund for Journalists covering COVID-19, reporter Anna Stitt has part two of her series of Arkansas prisons and coronavirus.
My big brother's like my best friend, my everything. With him being incarcerated, he still helped me out a lot.
Tatiana Harris lost her brother, Derek Coley, on May 2nd.
When I need to talk, I need to cry, he there. Even though he didn't like it, he was there. I mean, that's what any big brother. Girl, stop crying. Dry them tears.
She'd never known him to get sick. She said he called her on April 10th, right before her birthday. Then his family stopped hearing from him, and they heard COVID-19 was inside Cummins. So Harris called the prison.
I called, but they wouldn't tell me nothing. They wouldn't tell my sister nothing, my big sister nothing either. So with his baby mama, his little girl's mother, she called.
I just kept calling. They were just saying, oh, he's still not showing no more symptoms.
That's Cecilia Tate. She and Coley were raising their 8-year-old daughter together. She was listed as an emergency contact, so she was the one the prison would communicate with. She says a prison nurse told her that Coley had tested positive for COVID-19, but that his fever had gone down and he was doing fine. But family members of other people incarcerated at Cummins were reaching out to tell her Coley was really sick.
The next thing I know, at 1:37 a.m., May 3rd, I got a call from the chaplain and told me he had passed.
Arkansas pays WellPath, formerly known as Correct Care Solutions, about $371 a month per prisoner to provide health care. But I spoke with two nurses who claim that WellPath spends as little as possible of that money. Amy Burrow worked in Arkansas prisons as a nurse practitioner for a year and a half, leaving this past November. She says when she was hired, WellPath's regional manager told her,
as the provider, you make the decision of what's needed. If you order this, we will get it for them, but absolutely not. Nope.
She says instead, the administrator at her prison often denied her requests for medical supplies or chose cheaper but higher risk medications.
It was being undermined by people, money, 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 money.
WellPath's contract with the Department of Corrections shows that the Cummins unit has one doctor, fewer than 4 nurse practitioners or registered nurses, and fewer than 14 licensed practical nurses or LPNs. LPNs are not trained or medically allowed to assess sick people without supervision. WellPath's policy manual is not public, but nurses say that inside Arkansas's prisons, LPNs are the ones who see prisoners when they place sick calls. And they say they're told that each prisoner should make 3 sick calls for the same symptoms before they're scheduled to see a doctor or nurse practitioner. Burroughs says the time between each of these steps adds up.
Let's say that they followed that exact process, then it was 10 days minimum before a provider seen a patient, but a maximum of 20.
Even with these delays, nurses say they're often hundreds of sick calls behind. The prison switched to a mostly electronic system 3 years ago, but people in isolation don't have access to it. Burrow and another nurse allege that to avoid fines from the Department of Corrections for seeing people late, WellPath staff sometimes shred paper sick calls without scanning them into the system.
Well, there's no tracing of these handwriting sick calls. I witnessed them shredding sick calls. They would look at the name and not the complaints and would say, oh, this one wrote a grievance last week because blah, 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 blah. I don't want to deal with them, and shred it.
And Burroughs says she saw Black prisoners get neglected while white prisoners with equivalent needs got treatment. She saw people with life sentences get turned down for operations, while others with less severe health issues got what they needed. We reached out to Department of Corrections Secretary Wendy Kelly. She declined an interview, but said in a written statement that the department denies the allegations. We asked what measures the department has in place to ensure that WellPath staff are not shredding sick calls before they're scanned in, or treating prisoners differently based on race or sentence. She said they would investigate if they received any evidence, but they have not. Amy Burroughs says she reported her concerns to the Board of Corrections chairperson, but he told her WellPath is a private company and his hands were tied. She then reported her concerns to WellPath management. She was fired 3 weeks later. When prisoners are seen inside Arkansas prisons, each sick call costs $3, which can add up for a population paid nothing for their daily work. The Department of Corrections eliminated the $3 copay on March 23rd due to COVID-19. But Corrections Secretary Wendy Kelly reinstated the fee on May 1st. She said medical staff were flooded with requests to be seen. She made an exception for inmates with COVID symptoms, but she said that nurses would be the ones to determine whether the symptoms were COVID-related. Medical records show Derek Coley was too weak to walk to the infirmary the day he was tested for COVID-19. He was quarantined in isolation. For the next 2 weeks, nurses' notes claim Coley had no complaints. But I spoke with another prisoner who was in isolation at the time. He said prisoners near Coley had been asking nurses to evaluate him as they saw him getting weaker and weaker. In the 24 hours before Coley died, 2 long-term Cummins prisoners who had COVID died in hospitals. That night, prisoners broke windows and set trash cans on fire. Here's Coley's older sister, Shatasha Harris.
I feel like that's why the riot broke out, because they're not giving them people the proper medical attention, and these people know that. So they mad, you know, and they see these other people in here not getting medical attention, so yeah, they mad. And then if you done been locked up with somebody for 7-8 years, you've grown a relationship with them.
Division of Correction Director Dexter Payne said the unrest was quickly dealt with and no one was injured. But photos leaked from that night show injuries from rubber bullets. And prisoners report mace or tear gas so intense that many struggled to breathe. Here's DeMarco Rayner, who's incarcerated at Cummins.
And we started to smell it down here in 15 Barracks, where I'm at. And it was beginning to choke us down here. I was shocked that they had put tear gas out there, knowing that almost 900 people are positive respiratory virus.
Tear gas irritates the eyes, throat, and lungs and can make it hard to breathe. It can also permanently damage the lungs. We requested records for the extent to which prison staff used rubber bullets, mace, and tear gas that night and where in the prison. The Department of Corrections said it would send the records by May 29th, but it still has not. The coroner's report says staff were moving Coley to another part of the prison around the time of the unrest when he had a medical episode. Medical records say when nurses arrived, Coley was on the floor outside the prison's isolation unit. His lips were pale. He was struggling to breathe. It appears the most trained medical staff in the building that night were licensed practical nurses, or LPNs. Cummins' only doctor, who records say the nurses were in touch with that night, has a revoked medical license, though the Arkansas State Medical Board gave him permission to keep practicing as long as he updates them. His license has been revoked 3 times over the last 20 years due to drug use. including treating patients while under the influence. It was last revoked in 2018. The coroner's report says Coley had no medical or surgical history, that he had COVID-19, and that he died that night. The Department of Corrections said they did not consider Coley's death to be COVID-related. The autopsy report determining cause of death has not yet been released, though Coley's body has already been cremated. Derek Coley had been eligible for parole since June 2017, but he'd been denied each summer since then. Cecilia Tate, the mother of Coley's daughter, says he hoped to come home this month. Instead, she got his belongings from the prison.
I just got his Bible. I got his glasses. Two radios.
She says Coley wanted to one day open a barber shop. He told his 8-year-old daughter they could be in business together when she was older. He could cut hair. She could do nails. Instead, she's getting her dad's ashes.
His baby, she wants a necklace and an urn. So we're giving her first choice.
Coley's older sister, Shatasha Harris, says the two of them had plans to take their kids to the beach this summer. Coley had never been to one, and he wanted to see more of the world. So when the COVID-19 pandemic is over, she plans to take her portion of his ashes and release them over the ocean. Cecilia Tate is focused on just getting through each day and supporting her daughter as she grieves.
We're going to miss him. I know he put up a good fight. I know that.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Anna Stitt.
That was the second of a 3-part series on COVID-19 in Arkansas prisons. Tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, what's next for state prisons?
My name is Brian Rashow. I live in Boulder, Colorado, and I am the Deputy Director of Communications for the City of Boulder. I was a producer for Ozarks at Large from 2007 to 2010. I would say on a serious note that what Kyle Kellums and Ozarks at Large and KUAF provided me is hands down the best thing that happened to me in my career. It is the reason that I was able to make the leaps and bounds that I have in my career. It's the reason I'm where I'm at now, is because of the opportunities that they gave me at Ozarks at Large, the opportunity that Kyle gave me to report, to really hone my skills. And I would not be anywhere near where I'm at if it wasn't for Kyle Kellums, Ozarks at Large, and the whole KUAF family. And you're listening to KUAF 91.3 FM.
Thank you for those kind words, Brian, and thanks for all of your contributions during your time here. We've had so many voices on this program the past 30 years, and those voices are big reasons we've been able to produce this program as a news magazine since the winter of 1990. But you're a big reason, too. A program like Ozarks at Large can't begin, continue, and thrive without your support. From your ideas, to your attention, to your financial support. This month, we're concluding our fiscal year at KUAF, and we're raising $35,000 to end this year strong and independent, a most unusual year, we can all agree. If you're able, you can contribute online at support.kuaf.com, and thank you. And it's time to hear from another wonderful voice, that of Raven Cook. She's creating new editions of Reflections in Black from her home.
This is Reflections in Black, and I'm your host, Raven Cook. Reflections in Black is a segment dedicated to exploring the legacy of Black Americans in the United States and around the globe. Reflections in Black also provides resources for understanding and hope for all people. During these unique times, I've been trying to find shows to watch. Recently, I stumbled on a series about Black veterinarians. Strangely, I've never known any Black people who went into the veterinary sciences, so I was delighted to see this. But it got me thinking, who laid the foundation for these men? Who was the first? Augustus Lushington was born on August 1, 1869 in Trinidad. A young Augustus would go to school in Trinidad and eventually worked as a teacher and principal before traveling to Venezuela and finally setting off for New York in 1889. Lushington would meet his wife in 1890 and enroll at Cornell University, where he studied agriculture. In 1894, he would graduate and continue his education at the University of Pennsylvania and become the first African-American veterinarian. Augustus Lushington would go on to work in numerous positions as an instructor and federal employee in the Federal Department of Agriculture. But Dr. Augustus Lushington would continue a life of service until he passed away February 1939. During these peculiar times, it's critically important that we recognize a foundation has been laid for us. Those who have come before us have seen so many difficult adversities, so many hard things, and they've given us in our genes and our blood cells running through us right now the courage to persevere through all adversity. Today we celebrate the life and legacy of Dr. Augustus Lushington, but I want to definitely encourage you to be thinking about the people who push you every day, whose lives are symbols of courage and perseverance for you. Hold them close to you in your heart. Learn more about them. Learn more about those that we're discussing on Reflections in Black. And know that we'll get through this time together.
Reflections in Black is a production of KUAF Public Radio in Fayetteville. You can hear weekly segments on Ozarks at Large, and you can find past editions at KUAF.com. Just search Reflections in Black.
And tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, Blake Robertson is retiring as president of Northwest Technical Institute.
I feel privileged to have run the last career and technical school in Arkansas for 6 years. And we've done a lot of good things.
Details on his legacy and successor on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 on 91.3 KUAF. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Wyola. 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Contributors tonight included Susanna Sitek and Anna Stitt. Timothy Dennis mastered today's show and today's Reflections in Black, which is hosted and written by Raven Cook, founder and president of Foundation's Black History Education Programming. Additional assistance for tonight's program provided by Michael Hiblin with KUAR Public Radio for Central Arkansas and Little Rock. Our theme, written and performed by Daryl Sean. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for listening. We're back with you tomorrow at noon with a brand new show. Have a good night.